and I'm in. Oh, I'm so pleased this is being recorded too. I think that's really cool. I love listening to AA speakers. My sobriety date is 10/14/10. October 4. I had to memorize that 10/14/10. Like, I don't know why it was such a thing, but I had been coming in and out of AA. When I got sober, I had been attending meetings and working the steps and, with a sponsor for 3.5 years. And I would just drink again. And I didn't, I kind of would come back and I thought that, I thought that I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. Like, and I really truly thought that, but I would end up coming back. And on that day, it was a noon meeting that I attended, and it was about 11:15, maybe 11:20. And I know that because I looked at the clock and I was speaking with my roommate, and the kids were inside, and I said, I only have enough money for a six pack. I don't, maybe I'll go to a meeting and then go pick up my paycheck. 'Cause, and I was broke. And, maybe I'll go get my paycheck and then start drinking after the meeting. And, that I was just hopeless. I was just hopeless. But, I did go to that meeting and I did pick up my paycheck, but I another 24 pack. And it's a huge mystery to me. Like, I had come to meetings so many times where I had blacked out or I had truly pathetic routine where I would, my kids would be either at my cousin's or at their dad's, and I would sit alone in my room and try to drink myself to death. And I thought that, that would be some, that was a reasonable, it was like, I was so, I didn't know this, but I was like so heartbroken. And another thing that I didn't know was that I had to somehow gotten this belief in my head that I had killed my mother. And what happened was she was really sick. She was really sick. And they had diagnosed her with all kinds of stuff, like pneumonia or whatever. And what they found after a while was that she had a rare mold, a common mold growing in her lungs, and it was rare for people to have that. And she wouldn't survive a lung transplant. And I remember really vividly, like saying, well, what are you gonna do? And then everybody in my family, all of the doctors, everybody said, it's up to you. Well, you're the oldest daughter. You're the only one that has it together. Like, I did not have my shit together. But they said, they really said that. And I turned to everybody I could think of for advice, and everybody said, like, whatever you decide is the right decision. So I said, well, let's take her off the ventilator. And man, and then the most, I mean, this was really fucked up. They said, well, when do you want to do it? Do you want, and so I didn't know. I just said, well, let's, and then talk to my brothers, and my grandma, my mom's mom. And I said, well, Monday at 8 a.m. And she passed away, within a few minutes. It was really fast. And I didn't know that I believed like that I had killed my mom. Like I was completely clueless. But the like, and I had tried everything, you know, like all the prayers and all, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. And I just couldn't deal with it. So I drank. I was genuinely completely clueless about that. And that was something that I had to kind of treat separately. And like, so now I know that I have to treat like that kind of depression and grieving. I treat those separately than the AA 12 steps. Because in the 12 steps, you know, we look for what we did wrong. And man, I was doing the steps and doing the steps, and I found everything that I did wrong. And people would tell me like, no, no, like that was not wrong. You were not wrong. And, you know, it just, it, like it never set, you know, like it just didn't stick. So I had, been able to make it to a few counseling appointments, and I didn't really know like what alcoholism was and what depression was, and you know, so all of those things. Like I knew, you know, kind of technically or clinically what they were, but when you're in the middle of that and experiencing that, it's, you just can't identify it. So I had like, thank God I had found somebody who could explain it to me in like not plain simple English, but she could explain it to me like I didn't have the power to decide when somebody dies. Like I just didn't have that kind of power. And the way she explained it to me, I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, I really don't. Like, it was just like, you were so right. Oh, my gosh. And so those, you know, that delusion started fading away. But really, AA, man, like I remember, I am now, well, like I've been sober for more than 14 years, but now I am glad that I got to show up for those 3.5 years and end up going back out drinking and doing the inventory and going back out drinking. And like, I drink because I'm an alcoholic. There's no other thing, you know, it's not because, you know, this happened or that happened or things weren't going my way or anything like that. Like, I drink, I'm an alcoholic, and that's what we do. And getting it in, like in my brain, I had these ideas that I think I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And when I figured out what alcoholism is, like, man, that's too young, right? So I figured it out when I was a kid, and I just stuck with it. I didn't have any teachings or anything. And I just decided an alcoholic was somebody who was always insanely drunk or somebody who was always insanely sober. And it's just, there's no taking the crazy out of it, because that's what I had seen. And it wasn't until later that I was able to recognize that I knew some alcoholics who had some recovery, right? Like I don't know, just really, I was obviously, like when you're 8 and 9 years old, you're just really self-centered. There's no way around that. But I had carried that around for a long time too. And like this, the selfishness and, you know, trying to get things to go my way, trying to figure out how I'm going to get what I want was something that I learned, like, it's the easy way, right? I learned the easier way to get away with things. And, you know, one of those things about lying and having relationships, this is much farther along, but I had just decided that I could not trust people was one thing. Like, and I just knew that. I knew that with every ounce of my being. There was not one single human being on earth that I could trust, that, you know, it was going to be like lies and manipulation, or, you know, people are just out to use each other and get what they want. Like I had had some experiences with people who thought I was close to, and our drinking, with the way that we drank, that's just the way we had to be. So, you know, I was kind of carrying that around and not getting it at all, not being able to trust anyone. And the only way that I was ever able to work with a sponsor was, there was a woman who I would talk to her all the time, and I hear things in her voice still to this day. And she would tell me things like, "We got to figure out how we're going to keep you sober, Josie." And I was just like, "Yeah, let's do that." But one time she's just like, "See, have you tried sitting on your hands? Maybe you should just sit on your hands," and like all kinds of stuff. And man, sitting on my hands worked for me. Like, that was something, you know, I was like a 3-year-old going to timeout, you know, just sitting on my hands. And that one day I told her, you know, we were talking about that and I just didn't trust anyone. And she just said, "You don't have to trust anyone. You can, you know, you can trust that an alcoholic is going to lie, cheat, and steal. That's, you know." And then, man, I was just like, "Oh yeah, I could totally do that." Like that, you know, that was that. I mean, I could too. But, and then, one day, the older kids had gone out trick-or-treating, and the toddler, now this is a toddler too, the toddler had, so they came back and the toddler had stayed home with me, and she took my daughter Denali's pillow cover full of candy, and she went into her bedroom closet and shut the closet door and sat in there eating her candy. And I don't know, we just kind of didn't notice that she was missing for a few minutes, you know? Like, and then it was just kind of like, "Where's Cassandra? Where's the baby?" And then everybody started panicking. Like, we did not have a big house. It was like a 3-bedroom house. So, you know, you didn't have to look too long. So we were kind of started panicking, and we found this little kid in Denali's closet, and she had chocolate melted onto her face and it was on her hands. And, you know, we were just like, "Oh, thank God you're safe." It was really kind of the relief of it. And then it was like, "Are you eating Auntie Denali's candy?" And she just got, I mean, the little huge chubby cheeks, you know, the big eyes, like, honest to God, no, like, and right there, I was fine with, people are gonna lie. Like, I kind of understood something with that, like, you know, like, man, we just want to take our candy. We just want some candy, man. If you got to go in the closet to eat it because you know you're gonna get in trouble, then that's what you got to do, right? Like, there was so much, like, all of the stuff I had been doing, all the questions and the prayers and, you know, working with others and sharing meetings and, you know, all of the stuff, like, it kind of clicked, You know, like it's fine to be a liar, cheat, and a thief, you know, like totally fine. So, you know, and that was something, those kind of things, they've come up, oh, you know, quite a bit through my recovery. So, you know, there's a part of the step work where, okay, I guess I'm jumping around. So when you get to the ninth step, you know, you do the ninth step. And then after that, if your situation still isn't resolved, you go work with another alcoholic, like vigorous, you know, vigorous work with another alcoholic or something like that. And so I ended up chairing this meeting, and like I had, it was like it was like the only thing that was left for me to do on the ninth step with a, you know, with a situation that was kind of serious. And it was like, it wasn't really that bad, but like my brother had a, anyways, I ended up with his daughter, and he was found dead in a creek, and I was trying to get custody of her, and I couldn't do it. Her mom would not. I mean, it was just so much. It was a lot. It was a lot. And, you know, like I just finally kind of gave up on it. And the only thing that was left to do was that, vigorous work, right? So I started chairing this meeting, and man, what a blessing that was. So it was a meeting at 4 o'clock, and it was near the courthouse. So here, I know we're all over the country, but here in Whatcom County, people can, you know, take their little slip and go get it signed. And if they go to a bunch of AA meetings, then they get to, get out of their DUIs and stuff like that. So that was that meeting. Like, you know, court was, you know, court gets out, and then everybody hits up this 4 o'clock meeting. So I remember doing that. Man, I chaired that meeting for a long, long time, and like I just completely did not get, like, this has nothing to do with my problem, and you know, this, it just was complete nonsense to me how going to try to help another alcoholic was the right thing to do. Like it is, I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me at all. But you know what? Like I started to really like the people in the meeting, like really, you know, getting to know each other and talking about like all the stuff that's going on with our alcoholism. And I think my favorite part about that was that I could recognize that my problem wasn't really unsolvable. Like it, I would, it was a, I was a little bit less self-centered. Like, and there is no way. I mean, that is absolutely the only way that I would have ever been able to, you know, relate, like to, you know, just to be able to stop thinking about, like, oh, I got to solve this problem. And, you know, oh my gosh, don't you know how important it is? And all this stuff. But, you know, like that, I didn't get custody of that kid till she was like, she was old. It was just a few years ago, and she needed a surgery. So I had to go to court and get emergency custody of her. And it was like, man, when that happened, it was probably, oh, I don't know. She was a kid. She was a kid. But so those kind of things, I think they're just really, I'll, at the mo at the time, you know, it says like having had a spiritual awakening, right? I didn't know that those were spiritual awakenings at the time. I was completely, absolutely clueless, absolutely clueless. And like I've gotten, when I kind of, I was trying to kind of like reflecting on it today a little bit. And like earlier today, I got to hear the word enlightenment. And you know what I thought about was that there's support. There's a, in the four step, when we're answering the four step, you know, we go check off the boxes, like, does this affect my ambition, my security, my self-esteem, my personal relationships? You know, when you check off those boxes, like for me, like that was enlightenment. Like I was just like, oh my gosh, this is totally enlightenment. I had no idea that I was this insecure. I had no idea that I didn't even have one honest personal relationship with another person. Like I had no clue at all. Like it had become my number one priority to protect my reputation so that I could drink as much as I possibly could. Like it wasn't even, I didn't even think there was anything wrong with that. Those kind of was enlightenment for me, you know, and it still is. Like when I kind of, every once in a while, I'll get into something where I, you know, have to like do some step work and tell somebody else about it. It is still like that. Like after all this time, things where I want to keep it to myself. And for me, like I did it enough over and over and over. I know that it's not like I'm going to start planning a drink. Like, that's not going to be the thing. For me, it's when I start planning my story, when I start trying to protect my reputation to make myself look like the good person and make other people look like the bad people. That's when I know I'm going to go out and drink again. And man, that's just like, I think I, you know, when I first saw this steps and then I was just kind of like, oh yeah, no problem. Like I really thought that doing this stuff would be no problem, but it is hard. One of the things I heard in a meeting a long time ago was that I didn't get a brain transplant. Like, I'm just kind of like, oh man. And that really stuck with me. Like, I did not get a brain transplant. My brain still does all the little calculations and tries to figure out like how I'm going to make things go the right way, because I think that's just the way it's supposed to go. And another thing that is, I heard that really helped me a lot was, they're out writing their four step. Like we were talking about somebody, you know, who had not been to a meeting for a while and who did have some recovery, and they went back out and hadn't done the step work. And like, I was just like, oh, that is so, I mean, what are you, that, because it's heartbreaking, like, to come to meetings, to be going to meetings on a regular basis, like, and see the same people all the time, and then they disappear. And, you know, a lot of times they, you know, after a while, you hear a lot about a lot of funerals, and you know, from people who've gone back out, and man, it's just devastating and heartbreaking. But that was something, you know, that has really helped me a lot. Like when it just kind of bothers me, like I have Al-Anon stuff too, but I've tried going to Al-Anon and I'm okay with it as long as I have another alcoholic drug addict who I am completely pissed off at, like just beyond pissed, like that fucking dumb shit, you know? So that is the I hit rock bottom with them, right? And there's plenty of people I kind of don't care about, but there's been a couple of people and I absolutely love them and they just go out drinking and I just want that. I just don't want that for them. And I want, you know, like, shouldn't they should be here for me or I don't know, for their kids, whatever. But one of my sisters is one of those. Man, I have to go to Al-Anon. But after I'm not like boiling mad that, you know, like I'll listen, be listening to the other Al-Anons. And they will talk about their alcoholic. And I just like, man, I just start feeling like, oh, I'm totally their alcoholic. Like we're some kind of pets that they have to go home and, you know, provide for and to put up with our shit, you know? Like that is something, you know, that I don't know, but the steps with alcoholism and having so many loved ones in recovery who are alcoholics, man, that has absolutely changed my life. Like the love and compassion and mercy that we have in AA is just not something like I mean where else? Like this is the way, right? When people are really acting out and you know, just absolutely like have destroyed, you know, their lives and even like hurt their loved ones, like, you know, with the brutality of the things that we do when we're drunk, that when they come in, like we are genuinely like so relieved that they made it to a meeting. Like, and that is something that is absolutely amazing. I think that is absolutely amazing that, and it's not even like any kind of a judgment or anything like that, but man, you if you pour love on somebody who has that much pain and suffering, like it heals them. It heals us. Like we heal each other by pouring love on each other's outbursts of selfishness and self-centeredness and you know that loneliness like as an alcoholic man the like what you know the loneliness of having to drink and wanting to have relationships with other people is it's like you know there's this empty hole in your heart and it hurts so much that there's no way that you could quit drinking, that there's just no way to quit drinking. So that is something that I just think is absolutely amazing. Like it's just as astonishing in AA. Okay, so where was I? I had started on a little spiel there. I was going to talk about some things like, okay, so, you know, some things that I've got to learn about also. I think there might be a couple of people in here who remember this. But a few years ago, I lost a daughter, and it was like a brutal, violent death. That same week, my dad died. And so, man, I just checked out. Like when I mean that was it was pretty hard. It was absolutely devastating. To find out that like the things that were going on, the violence that was going on with my daughter's and her boyfriend's relationship. And then, I mean, just all kinds of stuff was, it was just so harsh. And then I remember that because it was like Christmas Day. My dad, I had flown around the country, gotten my daughter's body, and brought her back to our homeland, to our reservation, to bury her. And that it was Christmas Day, and my dad picked her grave. And he told, he said, like, I hope this is okay, Josie. I went up to the cemetery and I picked a grave for Denali. And I was so grateful for that. Like everything he did, in that 5 days, everything he did was, he was planning her funeral. And then the next day he didn't wake up. And so, man, like I stayed sober through that. When I think about it now, that much heartbreak, let it's even stuttering saying the word, like I have never, I am still heartbroken over that. But one thing I've learned about that is, this is a new belief for me, but I think as long as we remember people who have passed on, that they don't really die. I think that's something that's been important to me. And another thing is that, like, I've done the steps on a lot of, like, I was I'm very shallow and vain, materialistic, like all kinds of character defects. Like, and I did the step work on all of that stuff. Like, man, and just do the steps on everything, absolutely everything, because this stuff really works. Like, I remember, one time I had this old vacuum cleaner, and I was pretty, like, I was pretty broke, and I was in grad school, and I had, a single mom and all that stuff. But this vacuum cleaner was like gonna die. It was gonna die, and it was gonna die. And every time I vacuumed the floor, I would say a prayer for this va I would pray for this vacuum cleaner. Oh, baby, you got a little life in you. I can get a job in like 6 months, 5 months, like doing this little countdown thing with them. But like everything, do the steps on everything. And but that vacuum cleaner, it made it through. I'm not joking around about that. The prayer thing at all. Like, man, just be praying over everything. Pray over your dishes, all the stuff. All the stuff. That is something that is really, I think that's really been a big life-changing thing for me. And but when Denali and my dad died, like I was so heartbroken and that I couldn't do anything. Like I just stopped functioning for quite a while. I think some people might remember that. But I think that it was, the prayers of my AA family that got me through that stuff sober. Like there is no other explanation for it. Like I couldn't do step work. I mean, I couldn't go grocery shopping with a list. Like I, that was stuff that really made a difference. And the like that kind of service, that kind of like to be sober for as long as I had, you know, I had been sober at that point for quite a while, and you know, 10 years, and to be able to show up and like try to listen to meetings and not really be able to pay attention, and so those things really make a difference. So that was just something that was really amazing to me. And I think I don't know, like doing this stuff, it really I don't know if I'm a better person or not, but definitely sober. So like not just not drinking alcohol, but sober, like in my heart, in my mind, in my spirit. And it's like, I love people, like I love them. So that's something that is truly a blessing. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for listening.